Hello and welcome to the Hockey Strength Podcast, the official podcast of SCAF, the Strength and Conditioning Association of Professional Hockey. My name is David Rosales, and today I'm joined by my guest, Tim Labaziere. Tim is the Assistant Strength and Conditioning Coach of the Boston Bruins. We've had one conversation before in November 2020 when he was the head strength coach of the Providence Bruins, so he's gotten the call-up to the big show. So we talk about a lot of his experiences that transitioned to the NHL. We talk about dorsiflexion and anterior tip training and that whole ankle complex. Tim has been experimenting some areas there. We talk about his recent presentation from the IHPS, International Hockey Performance Summit, data-driven approach from collection to implementation. And there we went really deep on how to actually apply data instead of just thinking about, we think of data as a super sexy topic, but Tim goes deep on how to actually make it useful for strength coaches of all levels, not just the NHL, because I think a lot of times, you know, especially NHL coaches and people with resources get caught up in forgetting that most coaches don't have the resources that they have. We also talk about dogs, being a dog father, because he now has two dogs, so, you know, always good to throw some dog stuff in there, and then books. This is a really fun conversation. Tim's a great dude. Him and I get along super well. We're kind of the same generation. So if you enjoy this episode, I highly recommend you go back and listen to our first episode together. That was in November 2020. And in that episode, we talked about individualizing a training program, which is also something he has an article about. Oh, and you may notice that Mike Potenza is not on the call today. We have just realized, as you probably have noticed, our lack of publishing podcasts is really because it's very difficult to coordinate three schedules. So I will be doing a lot more podcast hosting solo. Mike will be hopping on when he can. That is just how we're going to go. That's how we're going to roll with it, but we're going to get podcasts back out regularly. All right, enough for me. Here's Tim. Tim, welcome back to the Hockey Strength Podcast. Thanks for coming back on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man. I'm happy to be here and happy to be talking to you again.
We were just mentioning before we hit record that you've now gone two apartments since we last spoke. So a lot has changed for you in the last few years. Most importantly, you have taken a new job. Well, I guess it's kind of a promotion from the Providence Bruins up to the big club. So what's it been like in your first couple of years with the Bruins?
Yeah, it's been different in a good way for a lot of things. You know, I think a lot of people have asked me that question, like, what's the difference? Because realistically, it's the same job. It's just, you know, a higher level, better athletes, a lot of times older athletes, more resources. So there are a lot of differences, even though it's pro sports and it's hockey still. But I think what makes it the most different is that now it's me and Kevin Neal, our head performance coach. And there's so many, you know, rabbit holes that as performance coaches, we want to dive into a little bit. But when you're running a one-man show in the American League and you're doing meals, but you're also doing training, you're doing sports science, you're doing rehab, you're getting pulled in so many different directions. You're casting a really wide net, but it's not a really deep net to go into those rabbit holes. So now that we kind of have a specific roles between me and Kevin, you know, I do a little bit more sports science than I did before. And I do a little bit more reconditioning and rehab stuff than I did before. So I can dive down those rabbit holes a little bit and kind of almost make my niche a little bit stronger. So it's been interesting to learn some things that I didn't get to really learn before, but it's also cool just to see to win at the highest level, what it takes and everything.
Yeah. I remember our first conversation, we talked so much about mentors, and I think we'll talk a little about that too. And I'm going to ask this question, and I'm also going to say, I think in a few years, someone else is going to be asking another young strength coach what they learned from you, because I feel like you are now that up and coming wave of strength coaches who are going to be learning from years to come. But my question is, what has it been like to work with Kevin, or what's something that you've learned from Kevin that's really stuck with you in your time with the Bruins? Yeah, well,
first of all, I appreciate that comment. I think one of my goals as I get older, I'm not an old strength coach by any means, but as I get older, I want to, you know, hopefully get interns one day and help those interns and help Pat Dugan, our strength coach in Providence now, and help other people keep climbing the ladder, because a lot of people helped me. But working with Kevin has been great. You know, me and him already had a really great relationship because he is the one who hired me in Providence. So we already knew essentially from day one, 4 years ago when he hired me, like the eventual goal was to work together and share the same office, hopefully one day. I think we view training in a very similar way. He has a very maybe more analytic mind than I do. You know, he's done his PhD. He has a lot more years in the field than I do. So he can see things a little bit better than I can, especially he's been working with pro athletes for a lot longer than I have. So a lot of times it's me picking his brain on why he maybe chose certain exercises for certain guys. But it's also been really helpful because I think eventually he sees me, whether it's in the Bruins organization or with a different organization, being a head performance coach. So he wants to pick my brain a lot on, you know, if this was your show, would you do this versus this? Why would you do that? Or he just straight up tells me like, hey, just do whatever you think is right and I'll just follow along. So he's been great in not making me feel, you know, second on the totem pole to him, which realistically I am. But he does a great job at kind of balancing that. And we're also really good friends. You know, I've house sat for him before. He's, you know, bought me lunches, dinners, whatever. So he's a great friend and a great mentor. So it's been awesome so far this past year.
What do you think is a way in which you're very different from Kevin as a coach, or maybe just slightly different? You talked about having separate roles. What's something that you think you do really well as a strength coach that makes you complement what he does really well?
Yeah, I think not in a bad way, because both of us can go either direction, but especially as an assistant, I feel like I have to a lot of times be very buddy-buddy and approachable with the players. And, you know, I have less very serious conversations with the coaching staff. So I just think, and I'm also just an outgoing personality in general. So I think I probably come off a little bit more that way. And Kevin can for sure have that same personality, but he's a bit more reserved. You know, he has to essentially lay down the hammer on guys, you know, if their body fat's too high, if they're not sleeping enough at night, whatever, like he's ultimately the guy that is having those tough conversations with those players and the coaching staff and management and whatever. So he just tends to be a little bit more serious, a little bit more reserved, versus I'm more, you know, happy go lucky. I'll throw F bombs out all over the place. Like I'll be yelling, whatever. So we can both do both of those things, but I think I just naturally go one way and he naturally goes the other way, which works out really good in almost like a good cop, bad cop sort of way with a lot of scenarios.
So do you think one day when you're a head performance coach, do you think you're going to evolve your coaching style a little bit and have to learn how to lay down the hammer more?
Yeah. I mean, it's a balancing act for sure, because you don't want to be the guy that, you know, tries to command the room and is a dick because you're trying to, you know, tell this guy he's, you know, messing around, or on the flip side, you don't want to be everyone's best friend and you're not actually holding people accountable, because there's so many stories from years past across the league where strength coaches almost leaned a little bit too heavily that way. And general managers just got this view that they thought maybe they weren't holding players to the standard that they wanted them to be held to. So it's for sure a balancing act, because you don't want to be so much of a player's coach that, you know, management doesn't view you seriously, but you also don't want to be so much of a hard ass that players don't want to do things to help you out, you know, give and take, because you're just an asshole realistically. So it's a balancing act that you have to find. And I think, I bet you one day when I am a head strength coach, wherever that may be, I'll probably mess it up bad for the first year, and then I'll mess it up still bad the second year, but just less bad. And then I'll just keep going and progressing in that way.
Yeah, just constantly calibrating. Last thing on this kind of topic of mentorship and all this, I love a saying Coach Boyle has. He's very blunt. He's a very blunt speaker, and I admire that. He says, find smart people, steal their stuff. And I think as young coaches, I know I did that too. Like, I would just steal from Devin, basically, and I'm sure you'd just steal. But now I see you on social media and giving presentations as you're coming into your own and finding those kind of uniqueness. So I like the quote, you have to imitate before you innovate, right? But now you're getting to that point where you have more confidence innovating, which is really cool to see.
Thank you. Yeah. I still feel like I'm stealing everything from other people. You know, I think I might steal it from people and then sit on it for a little bit and try to decide how I actually think it's useful in my setting. You know, I think especially too, like I feel like a lot of the hockey performance coaches are already doing, say, 80% of things that are out there. So a lot of the stuff that I'm seeing now from hockey coaches, I've either seen from them before, or I've seen from someone else. There's still that 20% that I want to learn, but I'm trying to branch out to other sports and other, you know, sports scientists, psychologists, nutritionists, whatever it may be, and try and learn what other sports are doing, because realistically there are other sports that are doing things a lot better than hockey is as well.
For sure. And maybe a better way to think about it then is, instead of, we're like, really no one's coming up with anything new. I think philosophers have said that nothing since the ancient Greeks is new at all, but we have to consolidate and combine in ways that are unique. We have to kind of create new combinations that work, as you said, for your setting. So I think that's
for sure.
Great point. For sure. Segueing from that, I think you've had some great, every time you post a training post, I pay attention for sure. And one that grabbed my attention a few weeks ago was one on calf training and dorsiflexion. We'll start with dorsiflexion in particular, because we've all talked about dorsiflexion for years, right? There've been articles since like 2010 about this, hockey players and the ankle mobility, et cetera, et cetera. And then the description's always the same of like, you know, do those, you know, I don't even need to say the exercise, the one against the wall.
For sure.
So why don't you give us your take on moving, innovating further in that direction, how you've been improving athletes' dorsiflexion?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I probably talk a big talk, and I'm the biggest, you know, person to say like, let's just do some wall ankle mobility and we'll be good. But I'm trying to slowly branch myself out. You know, it was a concept I first saw from Matt Shaw at the University of Denver, and he was doing the Gray Institute 3D map stuff, where all joint movement is in a three-dimensional way. So you have to look at the ankle, although it moves mostly in the sagittal plane from dorsiflexion, start doing some eversion, inversion stuff, and also start doing some rotational stuff, which I think is important, but is hard for implementation, especially with the rotational stuff, especially in this sport, because they're in the boot all day long. So, you know, to even get some dorsiflexion on guys is hard. So then to get some eversion, inversion, and rotation is even harder. But then along with that, like, I started thinking about a lot about lower leg training when it comes to strengthening the ankle, because I think we do a lot for mobility because it's becoming a really hot topic, and getting more dorsiflexion and knee over the toe and leaving an eyelet open on your skates. But we're maybe missing something from a strength standpoint. And I kind of got the first initial ideas from like tissue remodeling stuff. And I think I started to do a lot more eccentric calf work. So I posted on Instagram about doing like single leg slant board calf raises, and really overemphasizing getting that heel down and dorsiflexion and the eccentric movement of that calf. I think something I'm still trying to wrap my head around is how to work that with the soleus, because I think a lot of the eccentric motion that actually happens at the ankle during sport movement or jumping or whatever it may be happens at the soleus, but I don't really want to do the whole seated, rest the dumbbell on the kneecaps and do calf raises that way. So still trying to wrap my head around that. But then another thing that we've implemented a lot this year is doing anterior tib work. So one that I kind of stole from, I don't even want to say his name, but that knees over toes guy that is so popular on Instagram now, is this wall supported anterior tib raise, which I started doing originally in rehab cases last year in Providence for guys that had knee injuries, and we wanted them to start running and we wanted to start acclimating them to the ground contacts. And even if we were doing jump roping and low level plyos, what we saw a lot of times is when they'd start increasing that volume, they'd get really bad shin splints, like a lot of hockey players do. So jump roping for that extensive plyometric modality has kind of always been a thing that I've done, but I wanted to start working, strengthening those muscles before they start seeing really high intensities with even tempo runs that aren't maximal. So we started doing that, and the first guys that did it will tell you that they were absolutely lit up from it. And I think it was a balancing act of finding volume that was appropriate for it. But then now what I think we're seeing is training both the calf and the anterior tib through that full range of motion without even working mobility. We're just increasing the mobility anyways. So it's kind of twofold, a strengthening and like almost a weighted stretch that we're getting, which is nice. I don't have any real evidence that it's working, but anecdotally it seems like it's working. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, it sounds like we're in the testing phase. I think it's cool to kind of talk through this testing. So have you experimented with where in the program this is going? Is this like a warm-up thing? Is this sort of at the end with conditioning? Have you tested different things? What's been working?
What hasn't been working? I've tried it two different ways, and one of them seems to just naturally fit better. I'll tell the first way that doesn't seem to work as good, which is just on lower body days at the end, because I think the guys tend to be so smoked from a nervous system standpoint anyways, specifically with the lower body stuff, that to stay around and do three sets of calf raises afterwards, like, you know, might sound cool day one because they're like, oh yeah, we're finally doing calves. But it's like, you know, week six of doing calf raises when we just did whatever, six sets of pit shark squat and whatever, however many sprints, like they don't want to stick around and do that. Those days are already long enough and hard enough. So how we generally do our week anyways is some sort of high-low model where we go lower body on Monday, upper body on Wednesday, and then a total body emphasis on Friday. And then those Tuesdays and Thursdays end up being like more corrective-based, mobility core-based, and then more aerobic conditioning-based. So for specific guys that need ankle dorsiflexion specifically, we have started to sprinkle that in on those days, which so far seems to be the best place for it. The little bit of a harder barrier is the in-season, because we do have a essentially corrective list that we get from our training camp testing that we kind of, you know, very ancient times printed out on a sheet of paper, get some scotch tape and put it up on the windows. And then on designated days throughout the season, we tell guys like, hey, go over, find your number, find what we want you to do and go for it. Because that's a little bit more sporadic, the guys that do it, we don't know if it's really working in the low doses that we're doing it in season. But for sure, something we're looking to do just from a corrective standpoint in general, making those a little bit more strategically and consistently placed in season.
I love how we're talking through this, and I can tell it's still experimenting. And I think a lot of times with podcasts, people, I do this too. When I go on podcasts, I bring like my most polished, like the best stories I got, like everything. I know every word, I've rehearsed it. And yeah, Sometimes it's more effective to hear coaches, how they're thinking about the process of testing new things. So I really invite coaches out there to look at both these posts. We'll link them. Obviously there's one on dorsiflexion and one on tib strengthening, but don't take them as like, this is the new thing. Take these as like, this is the first step and experiment and play around and test in your program. And kind of, as we said before, try to combine different ideas to apply it to a program that works for you.
Exactly. I agree completely.
All right. You also gave a presentation a few weeks ago, which is very exciting. So your presentation was called at the IHPS. Yes, IHPS. It was called Data-Driven Approach from Collection to Implementation. So why don't you give us a little overview about what you presented on?
Yeah, I think actually what we had just talked about is a really good transition, because in that whole, you know, testing phase of what we're doing, one big part of the presentation that I gave was that, like, I'm going to give you some ideas that I've used in the past, some ideas that we're currently using with the Bruins, and then some ideas that I have not implemented at all, whether I've seen it myself and want to implement it, or I've seen other coaches do it and we don't have the resources to implement it, or I don't realistically have the knowledge to implement it because someone's way smarter than me. So that was kind of the caveat I gave at the beginning, was like, I want to give you actionable things that you can do with your athletes tomorrow, whether you're, you know, a peewee strength coach, a high school, college, junior, pro, whatever it is, and whatever your budget is, which was a big emphasis as I've moved through the field, because I've worked in high school and, you know, AHL and NHL. So I've seen the different budgets. But what I was trying to convey with the presentation was, data doesn't have to be this like sexy, cool technology that everyone thinks it is. That's obviously super gold standard, but not everyone's going to have force plates and gym aware and 1080 sprints and 1080 quantums and catapult. It's just not realistic. So, you know, data can be as simple as getting muscle girths on legs and arms and chest if you have a hypertrophy focus, or it can be as simple as getting one RMs if you have a strength focus. You know, different things like sprint timing or vertical jump measurements that can be, you know, really cheap to get a jump mat or a Vertec to get those things. You can do power measurements on a assault bike or a watt bike to get some sort of peak power measurement. There's so many different rabbit holes that you can dive down, but regardless of where you're at, you can get data and you should be using that data to make decisions. And I think another problem that we also have in the field is like we collect all this data and it sounds really good. And then we, okay, we implement different programs because this guy needs more strength or this guy needs more speed, but then we never retest throughout the year to see if we're actually making any actionable changes, which for sure I can say in the pro setting is extremely difficult. Something we kind of try and do, even if we're not, you know, retesting on a team-wide scenario, which we still do probably once a month, once every 2 months for tests, is if guys are, you know, severely lacking in hip adduction strength, that's for sure a really strong metric for a potential groin injury. So we will grab those guys once every 3 weeks and retest them to see if what we're doing to add into their corrective work is actually changing their adduction strength. And if it's not, then we change something. But if it is making an actual improvement, then we just continue doing what we're doing. There's no need to change something that's working. So, you know, that was another big thing I wanted to drive home in that presentation. And then the last thing I wanted to drive was actually getting data that means something. You know, we had talked about this when we were at the combine because SCAF has a sports scientist that came in and gave a really great presentation. He was talking about the hip strength numbers that they did at the combine. And in years past, they've always tested at the ankle, which is how it's supposed to be done. And then for whatever reason this year, the testers didn't know what they were doing and they tested at someone's knee, which obviously for anyone who knows, you know, lever arm, someone's going to be drastically stronger if you test them at the knee than the ankle. So although we have data, that data is now garbage and we can't use it anymore. So getting the correct tests is obviously important. And there's so many tests out there that everyone here knows what a valid test is. But if you're getting the valid test, making sure that one, you know how it's supposed to be tested, but then you know, implementing it the right way and actually analyzing the data to make some change.
Yeah. What gets measured does not always get managed. Actually, exactly. That quote is the most overused quote in SNC. Like the pendulum was, no one was counting anything. And then we started data became cool. Data became hip. Thanks, Devin, for writing that book about data, right? And now data is too cool and everyone's overusing it. I think one thing that worked for me. So I'm going to talk for the people with no budgets. I had a $0 budget for a junior hockey team. And instead of foam rollers, I brought an old bucket of softballs from my parents' garage. And I remember reading Intent and being all excited about all these different chapters and things to implement. And then I tried to implement too much at once. I was like, all right, we're going to do like broad jump testing, like with just a tape measure. And we're going to do like subjective questionnaires. It was way too much. And so what I learned was to implement one thing at a time. So I think that is what really worked for me. Curious. What advice you would have for maybe someone in high school or even honestly, like some colleges, some like D3 colleges or PB coaches, if they want to get into data and don't know where to begin?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of testing that you can do literally for completely free. I think kind of the big kind of rocks are muscle girth, body weight for anyone who's trying to gain weight, or if you just want to check in to see if your program's working from a muscle size strength standpoint. Everyone, obviously, if you're a performance listening to this, you have access to a weight room. So you can very easily test strength by doing any sort of 1 to 5 RM, whether you want to do bench press and trap bar or RFE or whatever, that's your choice, but everyone has access to those things. If you want to do some sort of power measurement, you can easily go buy a tape measure for, I don't know, I could probably find a tape measure on Amazon for $2 and take that out of my pocket. You know, you could do broad jump or lateral bound. I'm sure there's other tests that other coaches are doing, but I think for hockey, those two would be would be perfectly fine. Or if you have, like I said before, some sort of assault bike, you could do some sort of peak power sprint test, similar to a Wingate, just on an assault bike. And then from a wellness recovery and load management standpoint, like, everyone wants to talk about heart rate and catapult, but there's so many studies that say that session RPE to get load is, you know, very accurate. And you can start managing loads based off that. So just getting how hard was this session, 1 to 10, on a Google document realistically, which is free to everyone. Send that out. You just multiply that by the amount of time practice was. You can also send those out for wellness questionnaires, which is what we do. You know, there's a lot of things. We for sure have a lot of, you know, sexy, cool technology with the Bruins, but we also weigh in every single day on the most basic scale that you could ever do. We send out wellness questionnaires on a Google sheet every day. Like, yeah, we have catapult, but that stuff is almost more prevalent because we're doing wellness questionnaires every day and body weights every day. So there are so many different things that you can do, you know, completely for free. And then another big topic that I wish I had gotten to talk about more in my presentation, but realistically is one hard to put on a PowerPoint document, but I just didn't have enough time to mainly talk about it, but it's creating some sort of database and visuals that are good for coaches. I think a lot of people, because of the sexy technology, they want to, you know, get AMS systems and just have it, you know, visualize everything for them. But from someone who's used AMS systems and websites that our analytics department has sent us, we've used Tableau, we've used Excel, we've tried to use R. You know, Excel for most people is completely free. If you have a MacBook like I do, I don't even know what the yearly thing to get it is. It's like $200 or something, whatever. But you can do everything that you need from a data collection, analyzing and visualizing standpoint on Excel. And that's what I did up until this year anyways. So for sure, hone in on your Excel skills. I wish I could accurately describe ways to do that. But this podcast is not long enough to do that, but Adam Virgil has really, really good stuff on YouTube and on his website where you can go through. It's like, you know, a 10-part series, that are 10 minutes each that can kind of show you how to start collecting data and visualizing. And I went through probably 5 different presentations that he has and kind of use those to make everything that I've used from back when I was at Lynnwood to when I was at Providence. And now we still use a lot of those things when I'm with Boston. So definitely hone in on those things, so that's completely free.
Yeah. Shout out Adam. Adam has awesome resources on that stuff. Are there any, that's a great tip. I love the Excel tip. I haven't thought about that. I haven't really had to deal with that kind of visual layout. What do you think is a common mistake somebody listening to this and like, okay, I'm gonna start collecting data and start putting it on Excel? What do you think is one of the biggest faults someone's gonna make?
Yeah, I think it's really easy to just put numbers on there and think that coaching staffs and management and players will know what that means. You know, regardless of if it's, you know, something as complex as a force plate or something as easy as a broad jump, like if a guy broad jumps, you know, 100 inches, he has no idea if that's good or not. He just wants to know, you know, am I good compared to the team? Am I good compared to my position? If I'm in the American League, where do I rank compared to guys in the NHL? If I'm a high school kid, where do I rank compared to kids in college that I want to eventually beat out of them their spot? And then where do I sit compared to where I was before? You know, a guy who jumps 22 inches normally, he jumps 24 inches and he looks at that compared to the group and he might think that's abysmal. But if you have his previous stuff and you know that that's a 10% increase off of where he was before, then that's really exciting for that guy. So having the numbers is great, but having visuals, whether it's color coding based on standard deviation to the team average or the position average, or, you know, an up arrow or a down arrow to say if the player is trending upwards, that's really all that the coaches care about. They're not going player by player and saying like, okay, well, this guy's vertical jump is this, but his on ice recovery, like, they just want to know if the guy's doing good or bad in different domains. So I think any color coding you can do is great. Any, you know, realistically pictures and visualizations versus words and numbers are better, but obviously you need to have the numbers on there. And something that I wish I could remember who said it at the IHPS that I really liked that I think I want to start implementing more is that like coaches can be very irrational with taking numbers in a bad way. So I think it was Mark Lambert with the Lightning, but I'm not confident on that. He said something along the lines of like, when he's giving info to the coaching staff or the management, he only gives team-wide trends because he doesn't want anyone's data to get used against them. And if, you know, individual player data is going out, then that just goes to either the performance staff, the medical staff, or the player themselves. Because realistically, if a player needs a day off, the coaching staff doesn't need to actually see their number and their data. There should be enough trust within you and the coaching staff that you can see that number, analyze it for what it is, or the medical staff can do that, tell the coaching staff that they think they need a day off or they whatever need to spend extra time in the gym, and then work through that. So the player's data can't be used against them, and then the people that have the individual data can use it appropriately.
That is such an important point. I mean, we could get very philosophical about like the future of big data and privacy and all these things, but these big philosophical things that we think don't apply to us really do as strength coaches. The data we have is very personal to these players, and we have to maintain the responsibility that it's to help them, right? Not only for them, obviously, but even selfishly for ourselves. Like, how are they going to trust us if we're, you know, collecting all this data and turning around and telling the coach, and then the coach benches them next week? Like, how does that affect our relationship with the strength coach?
For sure. Yeah. Look at how it goes with the combine and realistically any sport. Like, players' values spike or drop based on them having poor scores. And that's, you know, when they're 17 years old, when a lot of them don't even have a training background. So then imagine whatever, a 26-year-old guy who's going into his first free agency, and the management wants to know if he, you know, if his power is increasing, that they think whatever, if they're going to offer him a 6-year contract, can you get to a certain point? Like, that data and those things have to be said very as a matter of fact, you know what I mean? Like, you can't say definite yes or no on certain things. So I think it's just easier to give general statements about the team and not really dive too deep into individual players, except for players, medical staff, and maybe player development.
Yeah. And then, wow. And then the one thing I want to underscore again is, if you're excited about data, is just start. This is my experience. Start one thing at a time. Make sure you actually know it. Make sure like you're good with it. Make sure your players are good with it. You have all the time in the world. Like, I think a good analogy is with training. We kind of get excited, like someone who doesn't work out, and then they're excited to go to the gym, and then they're too sore to work out on day two, right? It's kind of a similar idea here.
Yeah. Yeah. The evolution of where I've implemented data isn't just from nothing to where I am now. You know, I think I started doing data when I was in at Quinnipiac and at Lindenwood doing, you know, 1RMs, and not actual 1RMs, but, you know, we'd every third or fourth week of a phase, we'd have an open set of bench or front squat or trap bar, whatever it may be. And then you hit as many reps as you can on that open set, and we start changing one rep maxes to program off of that. Then, you know, I go to Lindenwood and we have jump mats and everything. So we start doing vertical jump on top of that stuff. Then I go and see Devin. He's doing a lot of RSI stuff. So I start going back to Lindenwood and doing that, along with some gym aware stuff that I learned from him. Providence was the first time I ever had to do anything on ice. So I started implementing some polar stuff. And then I still had the gym aware, the 1RM stuff, all that. And then now in Boston, it's evolved to, you know, catapults. You know, we're looking into potentially doing some loaded sprint force velocity stuff. You know, the evolution is crazy looking back from where I was 5 years ago and what kind of data I was collecting then to now. But that's not to say that 5 years ago I was collecting data wrong. I was collecting data, luckily, in the, you know, proper way for what my knowledge base and what my resources were. So I didn't flood myself with too much, and I don't want other people to do that as well.
Yeah, that's the process. Just like training, consistent training over many years yields great results. And it's, as strength coaches, it's the same, even though we don't take our own advice sometimes, right?
Exactly.
let's transition to you just added another dog to your family.
I did, yeah.
You have two dogs. You're now a double dog father. How has being a dog father helped you as a strength coach?
Well, I do have two dogs now. I have a husky and a short-haired pointer mix. They are wildly
names? Can we get names?
So the husky's name is Daenerys, like the Game of Thrones character. And then the short-haired pointer's name is Sadie. That is technically my girlfriend's dog, but we've moved in, so they are both my dogs now. But it's actually funny because I probably would have never even thought about this until you brought it up right now about like how does it affect me being a strength coach. And I would say like the only thing maybe it affects me is because I'm stressed out at home because they're whining in the crates all day or something. But no, the more I think about it, actually, they are wildly different dogs. My husky is so over the top, so talkative, not afraid of anything. And then Sadie, the German short hair pointer, is the biggest scaredy cat in the entire world. Like, we put a trash bag in the trash can and she goes and hides under the table. So she's just a big baby. And I think Sadie is older than Danny, so you would think that she would be the more mature and whatever. more mature and happy-go-lucky, not afraid of anything dog, but they're wildly different. And just like every player is wildly different, you know, just because a player that you're working with is 36 years old and the guy standing next to him is, you know, fresh out of junior and he's 19 year old, they might have wildly different personalities from what you even think. You know, the 19 year old might be very serious, very focused, very determined for what he wants to do. And the 36 year old might be a big goofball and he's made it this far because, you know, he has a good time and he loves hockey, but he might not love training. So you have to go into every player differently, just like you have to go into every dog differently. I think I just completely pulled that out of my ass.
That's so great. I didn't give Tim that question ahead of time. I told him I would mention the dogs. I didn't give him the specific question. What about, here's a harder question. We can cut this if you want, but what's something that you've learned about yourself being a dog father?
That my patience is very thin. No, I think I sort of already knew this about myself, but specifically with my husky, like I got a very high energy dog because I thought like, oh, I'm a strength coach. I'm a very high energy person, high energy personality. I want to, you know, go out on walks and run trails with my dog and whatever. And I think now I'm realizing that I do that so much at work that when I get home, I just like to completely shut it down. You know, I am so guilty of being the person who goes home, sits on the couch for 2 hours and like looks at the TV, but like doesn't even realize what he's watching. You know, I'm just like staring into the abyss. So maybe having a dog that would be a little bit lazier would be nice in many ways. So I think it taught me that I ebb and flow on my energy too. And I think that helps me, you know, the valleys help the peaks and the peaks definitely make the valleys happen.
Yeah. Those are great, great answers. Thanks for, I know those are tough questions, but yeah. I asked them because I think it's, you know, in SNC, we get really caught up in SNC and we forget that. I think for me personally, the best thing about strength conditioning has been what it's taught me about myself and about human nature and about people and how many of the lessons we learn are transferable across so many disciplines. There are so many times when I'm like writing an essay and I'm like, oh, Mike Boyle has this awesome quote, but no one's going to get it because they're not SNC, right? So I think all the things we do transfer to so many areas, and that's something I really love about it. For okay, sure. Last time I asked you about books and I went back and re-listened to it and that part went very well. So I'm going to ask again. I know you're an avid reader. I know you read about a lot of different things. So what's in the last year or maybe in the last week, if it's top of mind, obviously, one or two or three books that one SNC related, one maybe adjacent or less related that you've really loved and got a lot of value from?
Yeah, I have a very weird path of reading the past year where I've gone down a pretty big like financial rabbit hole. I think specifically with COVID, I think you saw a lot of people, you know, working from home and quitting their jobs and starting side businesses and retiring early and all that stuff became really popular. So not that I'm looking to retire, you know, next year or anything, but I think as strength coaches, we can all understand that none of us are likely to be on the floor coaching people when we're 65 years old, because not many people retire as strength coach. So I've been down a lot of rabbit holes that way. And a book that I'm reading right now, which is really good so far, that is extremely overdue for me reading, is Think and Grow Rich, which is great so far. I'm only about 4 chapters into it, but it's awesome. Another one that I read that I thought was really good was Psychology of Money, which
that book's great.
I think if you are into precision nutrition or anything like that, the concept of those two things are the exact same. It's just one's looking at it from a monetary standpoint and one's looking at it from a nutrition standpoint. So if you're familiar with those concepts at all, I think that book was awesome to wrap your mind around it from a monetary standpoint. And then I just finished on the plane ride home from Florida. That was my plane read, which I needed, was Mindless Eating, which I first saw Kevin Carr at Mike Boyle's place post about it. And I bought it immediately and finally read it. And it was very timely read on honing in my nutrition after a trip down to Florida. But that book kind of falls into the same domain as like the precision nutrition mindset, you know, on how specific habits without you even thinking about it can change nutrition for the better and hopefully make you lose or gain weight, whichever direction you're trying to go, without even thinking about it. So those 3 books, obviously I've read 2 of them and I'm in the middle of one of them, but those are good. I've read a lot of bad books in the past year, so I'm lucky to say that the last 2.5 books I've read have been really good. So
yeah, if you don't like a book, put it down. Don't waste your time. This life's too short. Read good books.
I've done it too many times, unfortunately. I'm too stubborn to put it down.
I'll add one more finance book that I really like, and I am biased because my friend has worked with him. But Ramit Sethi's book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich, very, very scammy title, good book. And Ramit is just the man. Ramit is just like, watch some of his Instagram reels. I think, like, again, a lot of concepts that transfer, right? Like, one I really like from his is don't ask $3 questions, ask $30,000 questions. Yeah. It's like, don't worry about buying coffee. Like, worry about the big rocks. And how often do we say that in SNC?
For sure. I'm going to write that down. I never heard of that, but that sounds like a good one.
Yeah. I'd say Ramit, it's R-A-M-I-T. It's at Ramit on all socials. And then his book is good also. So start with Instagram. And then if you like him, like I do, then his book's
I will, because you recommended him. So
a good next stop. He's great. He's really great. I mean, thanks so much, Tim. This has been super fun. The time always flies when we chat. We should definitely chat more. Any final thoughts or things you want to leave the audience with, places where people can reach you?
Yeah, no, I that's all I was going to say is I feel like so many times on whether it's presentations or podcasts, I just like ramble on and I like almost black out and forget what I'm saying. So I'm sure I touched on a lot of points that I wanted to touch on, but I probably missed even more points that I wanted to touch on. So if any questions pop up from this, or if anyone just wants to connect, like I said at the beginning, I think moving forward, one of the things I really want to do is connect with younger coaches or other coaches that may be older than me that I just haven't connected with. So if you're listening to this and you want to reach out to me, all my social media is just at Tim Labossiere, no underscores, no periods, anything. I know that's really hard to spell Labossiere, but I know David's going to put those in the notes somewhere.
It'll be in the notes. 2 B's, 2 S's. 2 B's, 2 S's. Exactly. That's the hardest part.
So you can send me a DM on Instagram or Twitter. I'm definitely more vocal on Instagram than Twitter, but I look at both of them. Probably don't add me on Facebook because I don't look at it. But you know, if anyone has my phone number and you want to text me or reach out or my email or anything, you can do that. I'm more than happy to answer any questions. And I hope anyone who has asked me a question via DM or email, I'm not putting my foot in my mouth right now and I didn't answer you or something. So feel free to reach out and ask questions, because I'm always open to answering anything.
And if you reached out and didn't respond, double text. Exactly. It's okay. People miss stuff. Well, yep. Tim, thank you so much. Have a great summer, dude. Enjoy the off season. And
thanks, man. You too. And enjoy Spain. I'm sure you're killing it over there.
Thank you. Yeah. Life's really tough for me right now. I'm traveling around Europe for 3 months. Yeah. Anyway, well, thanks again, Tim.
Thanks a lot, man.
Bye. Thank you everybody so much for listening. And thank you for your patience with our lack of podcast production lately, but we are back on the train. So if you enjoyed this episode, I highly recommend you go back and listen to the first one Tim and I did almost 2 years ago now in 2020, and checking out some of his articles on the site. He has a great one on how to individualize a training program that he developed when he was with Providence in the AHL. And for members, there's lots new coming soon. We are going to get some presentations uploaded ASAP. We got to figure out which ones we're uploading. So if you have a preference, if you maybe missed some of the events, let us know which ones interest you most. Let us know. That input is helpful. And if you're not a member, then head on over to the site. Tons of free articles, tons of podcasts. Honestly, re-listening to podcasts, underrated. I think re-listening to podcasts is underrated. Rereading books, I think, is also underrated. So I'm rambling again, but thank you so much for being back with us, and we will talk soon.